Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad you're with us for another edition of On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Some of the early details of the Pentagon's 2013 budget request are now out as it works to cut the military's planned spending by $487 billion over the next decade. And today we're going to take a look into some of the results of the strategic choices the Defense Department has made from a little bit different perspective, the military's reserve components. One of the cornerstones of DoD's new strategy is the concept of reversibility. Pentagon leaders say even though they're making some cutbacks, particularly with the Army and Marine Corps ground forces, they're being structured in such a way that those end strengths can be reconstituted pretty quickly, if that's necessary for a future contingency. And leaders say the reserve components are going to be central to making reversibility a realistic prospect. Our guest for the first half of the show today is Major General Keith Thurgood. He's the Chief of Staff of the Army Reserve. He and I spoke at the Reserve Officers Association's annual National Security Symposium here in Washington. Later in the hour, we'll hear the perspectives of some of the leaders of the other service reserve components who talked at that same symposium. General Thurgood and I started our conversation by talking about how much he expects the Army Reserve's end strength to get cut in the upcoming drawdown.
The Chief of Staff of the Army, in conjunction with the Secretary of Defense, as they've worked through this strategy and then resourced that strategy, he said that the active Army is going to come down to 490,000 soldiers. So over the next several years, we'll start to do that in a very methodical way, in a way that makes sense. In terms of the actual drawdown on the Army Reserves, I don't see that coming down significantly, at least in the short term. So in the Army Reserve, our in strength right now, our authorized in strength is around 206,000. We might go down to 205,000, so very small. But I think the good news in all of that is when this is all said and done, we're going to have a much more agile, leaner, flexible force to do what the nation has asked us to go do.
We also heard from Secretary Flournoy that the Guard and Reserve are going to be very important to implementing this notion of reversibility to the declining active forces. In the Army Reserve's case, how are you important to that process, and what's the value that the Reserve brings to this entire restructuring process?
Well, again, I think if you to put this entire conversation in context, so what we need to do as an Army is to deliver the capabilities the nation needs to fight and win its war. So the Army for the past 236 years has fought the nation's wars. They've won the nation's wars. They've stabilized countries. They've participated in humanitarian operations. And they've done all that because that's what the American people expect. And that's what freedom demands at the end of the day. So the reserves components are in a unique position right now to help build that capability, because we have a lot of what we call the combat service support elements, the enablers that help the combat teams fight and win the battles. So this is a great time for the Army Reserve. I keep calling it, it's a great time for us to make lemonade out of lemons. So we have capabilities that the Army and the nation needs to fight and win. And we can bring those to bear in a pretty significant way. So as this matures and unfolds, I think you're going to see a continued reliance on the operational reserve force, which we've essentially been doing for the last decade. And you'll see that force continually get better over time.
And those enablers that you have that you talked about, are those universal things that the Army will always need, or how much will that change and evolve? How will some of those enablers maybe go away and some new ones be created over the next few years?
Well, what we know about the future is we always get it wrong. But what I can tell you is, by and large, the enablers that the Army Reserve brings to bear are things that I would suspect the nation would need over a period of time. Truck drivers, quartermaster, medical units, civil affairs, of those we own somewhere between 60% and 80% of some of those units. So I think those units will continue to be valuable and could even potentially grow as we continue to evolve.
Mm-hmm. And with regard to the strategic review that led up to the budget that we're about to see, we've been hearing from everyone involved in it that it was a very collaborative, very open process with all the parties, that you didn't see the inter-service rivalry that some people might have suspected would crop up there. From your perspective, what were the reserve components' roles in there, and did you feel like you had input?
I think one of the great things that's come out of the last decade of war is that we as a nation, we as an Army, we are much more integrated than we've ever been before. And there's a really, I think, a deeper understanding now of what the total force means and what the joint force means. And our voice is heard through the Department of the Army, through the Chief of Staff, and through the Secretariat. So I feel like we had a voice in it. And again, if you think about how this came down, I wasn't personally involved in any of these, you know, meetings, but it's all about setting the strategy and then defining the resources you need to go execute that strategy. And so if you talk to the Chief of Staff of the Army and Secretary Panetta, it became clear to me that they had gone through some pretty due diligence on that process. And I think the reserve equities were represented in that well, and they were represented well because I think there's a general understanding that you can't fight and win without the reserve forces supporting the active component.
And to the integration point you just made, it's been said by some of those most senior leaders in the Army that the active and the reserve components are now indistinguishable on the battlefield.
Yeah.
Is that just a natural consequence of war, or did it take strategic thinking and planning and real work to make that happen?
Well, I think we're just now building. I think we're finally coming to the end state. Well, it's probably actually not even end state, but if you think about why the Army Reserve was developed and the vision of a joint force, going back to General Abrams as an example, I think it's taken us a long time to get where we are. And the war has been a forcing mechanism to do that. And so we're, as I mentioned earlier, I think as a force, a total force, the active component and the reserve components, we are much more integrated. We are much more agile and flexible than we've ever been. The challenge for us now is how do we maintain that capability going forward in the R4GIN construct or this progressive readiness model that you've heard people talk about? How do we play in that? How do we leverage that as a way forward?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Any early thinking on that yet? As far as, I mean, you're talking about staying operational, right?
Yeah.
Rather than just being a strategic reserve.
Right.
How do you do that? Do you have any of those answers yet?
Yeah. Well, you know, again, we don't know what we don't know in some aspects, but what I can tell you from an Army Reserve standpoint is, when we develop the progressive readiness model that we're calling R4GIN now, it may have some other name in the future, but the progressive readiness model is a very powerful tool because it gives us predictability in the United States Army. The Army knows what kind of units they're going to get. It gives our soldiers predictability. It gives our families predictability. It gives our employers predictability. So as these units rotate through this model on a 1-in-4 ratio, and they progressively get more ready to support either a named operation or a contingency of some time, it's going to be very powerful. So we've worked all this out in terms of our units. So we know where our units are in the model. And now it's a matter of making sure that we're going to execute and we have those capabilities available when the nation needs them.
When you hear Pentagon leadership talk about some of the areas that are going to see investment over the next 5-10 years, there are areas like cyber, there are areas like ISR, and those sound to me like capabilities that from a personnel expertise perspective, Guard and Reserve forces are pretty well positioned to bring to the table. You see it that way?
I think that's a great insight. In fact, as a community-based force, the unique thing about the Army Reserve is we've got civilian skills that we can immediately transfer into the United States Army and make a difference. And likewise, we can take the skills that our soldiers learn in the Army and come back to their civilian world and jobs and make them even better. So it's this interplay, this movement between active duty and the reserve that's very powerful. So those skill sets are that, you know, we're in the catbird seat on some of this.
Besides the things I just mentioned, cyber and ISR, are there things that stand out in your mind as skills that the reserve components really bring to the table that you maybe don't have in the active forces?
I think the challenge is how do we create the right mix of AC and RC units going forward in those capabilities. If I think about three tenets that the Army has talked about, preventing, shaping, and winning. If you think about what preventing means, well, preventing is about making sure that we're engaging with our militaries all across the world. And we're putting a different emphasis now on Pacific and South Asia as an example, because seven of the largest 10 armies in the world are in the Pacific. And in most developing countries and in most developed countries, the Army as an institution, their armies, are probably the most stable institutions and the most credible institutions inside the country. And therefore, we have a role to play in shaping that environment for the future. And our CA, our civil affairs folks, they are perfect for that because that's what they do. And as I said earlier, we own a lot of that capability. Another one along those same lines would be, in terms of shaping, would be theater security cooperation missions. So how do we leverage our skill sets all across the globe to support the combatant commanders in ways that will help them accomplish their missions?
That's Major General Keith Thurgood, the Chief of Staff of the Army Reserve, talking with me about the Reserve's role in the upcoming defense drawdown. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about how the Reserve plans to shape itself into a force that will take in the best and the brightest from the active Army as that service cuts back its end strength by 80,000 soldiers. We'll also talk about the Reserve's integrated human capital management strategy, still a work in progress. You're listening to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Welcome back to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu, and we're talking about the military's reserve components today and their role in the upcoming defense drawdown. Our guest for this portion of the hour is Major General Keith Thurgood, the Chief of Staff of the Army Reserve. In our last segment, he told me the Reserve doesn't expect its end strength to drop by very much in the coming years, even as the active Army cuts back by 80,000 soldiers. In this segment, we'll talk about the Reserve's plans to manage human capital and take in some of those soldiers who will be departing from the active Army.
I think it was General Stoltz, your boss, I guess, who this morning said the Army needs to start building a culture of soldier for life, similar to the Marine for life sort of value system.
Yeah.
But you want to talk a little bit about what that means, why it's important to the total force? And I gather a major driver is keeping soldiers, hanging on to them in some capacity so you don't lose that talent.
Absolutely. It's a great question. At the end of the day, what we need is an integrated human capital management strategy that allows our soldiers who want to transition from active duty into the reserve component to do that in a seamless and easy way. And that would include things like the pay system, the retirement system, the personnel record system. Today we don't have that. We're working towards that, and I think that'll be very powerful. It's really important we get this right now in terms of this idea of a soldier for life or a continuum of service. So it's not about I'm going to be off active duty and I'm out of the service. I still want to serve. So how do we make those transitions as effective and as efficient as we can? With the drawdown of the active force, this is a great time because we can take our skill sets that we've developed as a nation over the last decade of war that we don't want to let go and transition them into the Army Reserve, get the value out of them, leverage them for future operations instead of letting them walk out the door. So it's a very important idea, but it's wrought with complexities and whatnot. But hey, I have four rules of the road, and number four is solve for yes. So let's figure out how we go do that so we really do have this paradigm shift and creating a culture of a soldier for life.
And do you have a sense yet of how many of those active forces you can absorb? Because you guys aren't getting bigger, right?
Yeah.
And the active forces are.
Well, here's how we're going to attack that. So our end strength, as I mentioned, will be around 205,000. What we need to do in the Army Reserve is get rid of the deadwood. So if we have soldiers that aren't participating, they're unsat participants, they're low quality, what we need to do is say thank you for your service, but you're not going to fit in the future force because the future force is going to be smaller, and that future force is going to be more capable, and therefore we have to have quality people in the force. So our challenge is to get rid of the deadwood, create spaces inside of our formations that will allow us to absorb those that are coming off active duty. And we've got plans to do that. We want to play a more active role at the transition points all across the United States Army. We want to help them transition from the active force to the reserve force, which means I need a job. So we have an employer partnership initiative that will help our soldiers come off of active duty, help them with their resumes, link them up with employers, military-friendly employers, by the way, of which we have about 2,500 signed up right now. And so I don't think you can talk about any of these ideas necessarily in a vacuum, because they're all interconnected. When you think about building capabilities for the nation, you talk about preventing and shaping and winning. there are lots of levers that we have to pull, lots of arrows in the quiver here, and we have to get them all integrated and synchronized. But you know, that's the challenge.
I'm glad you mentioned private sector employment. It's such a tough labor market out there still right now. Any big successes that you've had so far as placing people who are members of the reserve into good jobs that they can hang on to?
Well, as I talk to our CEOs all across the globe, I remind them that the military, and the Army in particular, is the nation's premier institute for leadership development. And the Army does two things that every business wants. They grow leaders, and they deliver results. So you take somebody that's been in the United States Army, and I guarantee you, you put them into your business, they're going to start having an immediate impact. The return on investment on a soldier is quick, and it's high. So if you want somebody that shows up to work, has a value system, has integrity, is drug-free, understands how to collaborate and communicate, understands the value of diversity and inclusion, can think strategically and act locally, you want somebody from the United States Army. So our challenge now is, with all these vacancies that we have, especially in that generational cohort, kind of 18 to 24, which has almost a double unemployment rate versus the national average, we've got to get those folks into the right position. So this is, again, this is why this is such an important time in our history. It's an inflection point where we can really make generational changes that will impact the nation in a very positive way going forward.
Somebody else mentioned here at the conference this week that one of the observable changes in the Garden Reserve over the past years is that people used to get into the reserve components thinking that they'd never have to deploy, and then they got irritated when they did, and now it's the opposite. People get irritated when they can't deploy. Is that the case in the Army Reserve?
Absolutely the same thing. In fact, if you look at the data points, if you go back to the early parts of the war when we had high in strength and we were meeting our in strength numbers, when we started to deploy units, because we had a force that was strategic in nature and they weren't used to the op tempo or the operational construct, our in strength actually went down because we had people that said, look, I don't want to play. I thought I was only going to be a reservist 1 week in the month and 2 weeks a year. And so we dropped down a little bit. But as we started to hire the right kinds of soldiers, our in strength went up. And now our challenge is, how do you keep them motivated in an operational force construct? And that's why, again, if you think about retaining our soldiers, you think about recruiting the right kind of quality for the force of the future, for the Joint Force 2020, we have to keep those that we have in the force right now actively engaged and employed. And that's why, again, you can't think about any of this as kind of single entities. The progressive readiness model is important because you're going to have the opportunity, especially with the new authorities under the new NDAA, where you might be able to participate in the homeland defense in a different way. You might do something different if the governor asked for it. You might be responsible for disaster relief in Fargo, North Dakota. So this is, again, I think, you think about those new authorities, you think about theater security cooperation, you think about humanitarian aid, you think about the capabilities that we bring together. It really is a great time to be in the United States Army, the United States Army Reserve specifically.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about those authorities in the authorization bill. In what ways did not having those become a frustration in the past? And do you know yet some specific cases or, you know, scenarios where you might put those into play?
Yeah, well, we've always had the authority to react to save life, limb, and property in an emergency. What the new authorities give us, and again, we don't have total definition on any of this yet. We're not exactly sure how it's all going to play out. But under the 12304 authorities, and specifically Sections 515 and 516, the Army Reserve now under Section 515 can support natural disasters, and it gives the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Army specific authorities to call up to 60,000 reservists for about 365 days. We didn't have those authorities in the past, and the same thing with Homeland Defense. So we now have the authority to participate in planned operations in the United States. And again, all that's important because think of the practicality of this. So I'm using Fargo, North Dakota. It's probably a bad example, but a natural disaster happens in Fargo, North Dakota. What would normally happen, and we still want this to happen today, the governor would call out the National Guard because they're the first responders, and 90% of all the activities that take place are handled by the first responders. But what if they needed a bulldozer in Fargo, North Dakota, and the unit that they called up didn't have a bulldozer, or they couldn't get it for a week for whatever reason? I'm just the scenario here. Mm-hmm. Well, we might have a unit in Fargo, North Dakota that has just the exact equipment that they need. And the American people look at that and say, well, wait a minute. You're telling me I've got a unit right here that's in Fargo, North Dakota, that's got equipment I need. I can't get it out of the motor pool. And the reason we couldn't do that is because we didn't have the authority to do that. And so the governor, under his or her authorities, would go, you know, make all that happen. So now I think it's a great value. It's a great story to tell for the American people, because the American people, you know, they don't make a distinction necessarily between the active force and the National Guard and the reserve component. When the nation calls, they don't care about component. They want capabilities. They want something to happen. So I think it's going to be great once we figure all this out and we're clear on it and we work through some of the, you know, key processes and other policies and regulations that will govern all that.
So the main use really is when the military as a whole has this capability that just happens to be embedded in a reserve component, they can now go out and say, yep, go get that. And we're
in a nutshell, that's basically it. I mean, it's a little more complicated than that for a variety of reasons, but that's exactly right. Let's leverage the capabilities that we have to make a difference in our communities and the nation at large.
You've touched on a lot of this, but I just want to ask the question a little more broadly. At this transition point for the military as a whole, what does the reserve need to be doing right now? What are your biggest priorities over the next 1, 2, 3, 5 years?
Yeah, I think General Stoltz highlighted a couple of those today, but I think we could categorize those really under four big buckets. The first one would be institutionalizing R4Gen, and that's this progressive readiness model, and making sure that we as an Army are ready to support that, and more specifically, we in the Army Reserve, because we believe that it's a great model and a great construct for us to deliver the capabilities the nation needs on a ready rotational basis. The second would be what I would call shaping the force. And this would include all the equipping and manning. So getting quality people in the formations, getting the right equipment in our formations, making sure the people and equipment are ready to go along this cycle. It includes things like the continuum of service that I'd mentioned earlier, a lot of other activities around there. The third one is, I think, what I would call business transformation. So that is, we want to deliver the capabilities the nation needs under this construct in the most effective and efficient way that we absolutely can. So that means that we need to have a cost-conscious culture. And we need to be thinking about how we drive efficiencies across our enterprise and take those costs and either spend them on things that improve readiness or give it back to the nation, whatever that makes the most sense. And that would include taking cost out of the system, like I mentioned. Operational energy is another one that we've got to get focused on. And the fourth one, and this is probably the biggest one, it's around talent management. So how do we integrate, how do we develop and then integrate an effective and efficient human capital management strategy that supports? Because soldiers aren't in the Army, as one of our leaders once said long ago, the soldiers are the Army. And therefore, everything that we do is about growing leaders, about delivering a result. It's about delivering this capability. Coupled in that, and all this, of course, is supported by this whole idea of trust. I mean, if we can't get trust right, which is really the heart, in my opinion, of effective leadership, and we don't have that trust between the nation, because as the Chief of Staff of the Army has said, the strength of the nation is our soldiers. The strength of our soldiers is our families. And the glue that holds all that together is trust and collaboration. And so this idea of talent management, I think, going forward is really, really important, because it gets at the idea of a significant paradigm shift. We've got to start thinking differently about where we've come from and where we're going, because what got us here won't get us there.
That's Major General Keith Thurgood, the Chief of Staff of the Army Reserve, talking with me about the Reserve's role in the upcoming defense drawdown and their plans for the future. We talked at the Reserve Officers Association's annual National Security Symposium here in Washington. When we come back, we'll hear from the Reserve leaders of some of the other services who also spoke about their future plans at the ROA Summit. You're listening to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbio. Thank you. Thanks for listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DoD, and I'm Jared Serbu. Our topic today is the military reserve components and their role in DoD's new strategy and its upcoming budget. We heard from Major General Keith Thurgood, the Chief of Staff of the Army Reserve, in the first part of the show, an interview we conducted at the Reserve Officers Association's annual meeting here in Washington. All the other parts of the Reserve were at the conference, too, though, and we're going to hear from them in our remaining segments. First up, Lieutenant General Charles Stenner, the Chief of the Air Force Reserve. He says, much like the Army, he wants to use the Reserve in the coming years to let Air Force personnel become airmen for life, even as all components of that service reduce their size.
Something that does make the Air Force a bit unique right now is that we are trained and ready at the I can go tomorrow level, all three components, sorts, tier ready, tier one ready, and available. That has a key word right there, available and access. We are available and we are accessible, and we can go anywhere, anytime within 72 hours and have proven this most recently. So the objectives for me are to support the Chief of Staff of the Air Force and the Secretary of the Air Force and their objectives. To do that, first and foremost, I firmly believe we have been and will continue to be a strategic reserve for those major combat operations. I also believe that we leverage that strategic reserve on a daily basis to provide that operational force at a sorts Tier 1 ready status in conjunction with the other two components to put the forces where they need to be. That takes me to the second objective, and that is to preserve the viability of a reserve triad. If you're going to have an operational reserve, you've got to use it to the extent that you need it, but you've got to honor the dwell. In other words, there are folks out there with three parts to their lives. 80% of our uniformed folks in the Air Force Reserve have that military commitment, they have their civilian job, and then they have their family. The employers play a big part in that. I see that as a three-legged stool. If we can control the military commitment and control the civilian commitment, then you have a successful career in both. If we overuse any one of those pieces, that three-legged stool falls over. So monitoring and managing the dwell means to adjust and rebalance this force so that we have sufficient manpower to do what the strategic O plans require of us. We have sufficient manpower in each of the components to do the rotational requirements, and we in fact can continue to do the continuation training we have to do at a home base. That takes rebalancing. And in the Air Force, as you just heard, we are integrally intertwined. And try as we might to save some manpower, the integration of that three-component Air Force and our chief and our secretary's desire to ensure that we, in fact, retain that capability is taking us down in all three components to some lower level in the future. I firmly believe that we'll put that manpower back in the new mission sets that are coming up in the cyber arena, in the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, in the nuclear operations arena, and all of the different and varying mission sets that are going to have to grow in today's world. So I believe the reserve component needs to be every place that the active force is. Where there's an enduring mission, I want to be there. I want to catch that person that makes that life-changing decision and give them that opportunity to be an airman for life and continue to serve their country in a part-time status.
That's Lieutenant General Charles Stenner, the Chief of the Air Force Reserve, as we hear from some of the military reserve component leaders about DoD's upcoming drawdown and how the reserves will help the Pentagon implement its new reversibility concept. Next up, Vice Admiral Dirk Debbink, Chief of the Navy Reserve, who heads up a force of about 64,000 sailors.
Right now, we have about 4,500 of those sailors mobilized, most of them overseas, many of them in Afghanistan, as again many of us have. That's down from about 6,500 a year and a half ago, probably heading down to somewhere in the mid-3,000s by this time next year. In fact, one of the issues that we have today in our Navy Reserve that I hear about is sailors coming up to us saying, I can't get a MOB. I'd like to go on a MOB. Now, much of that's driven by the economy, certainly, but it does show the ongoing desire to be part of something perhaps bigger, more important than any of us as individually, and that's the great effort that's going on that our military is part of and that, frankly, President Obama spoke so well about the beginning of his State of the Union speech last week. Navy Reserve has three primary focus areas, strategic focus areas. The first is to deliver a ready and accessible force. We all need to be ready or we're worthless, basically, and so readiness is a key focus of all of ours. My belief is our sailors want to be ready. It's our goal, those of us in these positions, to help them enable them to be ready easier, more efficiently. We also have to be accessible, and as I think you probably all know, we all worked together over the last couple of years to Finally, this year in the National Defense Authorization Act, ensure that the Guard and Reserve will be accessible in the future. But there's lots of little things and important things that we need to take care of. In the Navy Reserve, we focused on a couple of them this last couple of years. One of them is I'm so proud of our Navy Reserve Forces Command down in Norfolk, who took on the charge of developing a world-class customer service program, attitude, culture at our Navy operational support centers. And that's not just for the sailors. That's for the sailors. That's for the family members. That's for any service member or any service member's family member or any retired person who is in need in that community. As Chairman Pinheiro talked about, we have over 4,000 facilities all across the country. You put all of us together, and we ought to be able to walk into any one of those and get what we need. And so world-class customer service is what that's all about. We also want to make it easier for our sailors to get online, because a lot of things they need to do, whether it's orders or whether it's training, is online. And so we're right in the middle of a rollout of Wi-Fi for every single Naval Reserve facility throughout the country, some 200 facilities, working with a contractor under a DISA contract to enable our reserve sailors to take their laptop in wherever they go, log on, get on NKO, AKO, get on NROs, whatever you need to do what we require you to do. Again, making it easier for you to be ready. Second major focus area we have is provide valued capabilities. Of course, we do that today. That's why we exist. The real question is, what will the Navy value in the future? And many times that comes down to talking about what specific capabilities, what specific requirements can we fill in the future. But it also comes down to this big question we have today of what is the right mix between the active component and the reserve component, capability by capability, and how do you optimize that mix? What kind of analytical models do we need? How can we help the decision makers get to the right place so we have not only an effective force, which we definitely need, we are the military after all, but also the most efficient force possible. So we've worked hard to help deliver a number of those models to our planners, and we'll again see that coming to fruition, I think, as we work through the POM process the next couple of years. Finally, the third focus area, as we've heard talk about already, is to enable the continuous service. Because without the Guard and Reserve, there is no continuous service. It's either 365 or goodbye. And so our vision is this highway. We call it the highway called Navy. Each of us has one, where there's an active component lane, an FTS lane, a cell res lane, even an IRR lane. And the goal is to be able to seamlessly change lanes throughout your career without all the barriers that have existed in the past. We've made a great deal of progress the last couple of years. There's still more to be done. And a couple of things that we've just accomplished in the last year. One is to focus a little bit more on the IRR. We created a program we call the Variable Participation Unit. Literally from 1 to 5 days a year, if you're unable to serve as a cell res or on active duty, but you have a skill set that we might need in the future that we value, we want you to come into our reserve centers. We'll pay you to do so, depending on the number of days you're able to do that a year. You might be able to participate in ADT or not, but the goal is to actually set up a billet structure in the IRR, which will be a first for us, so that we can tap into those skill sets in the future.
That's Vice Admiral Dirk Debbing, Chief of the Navy Reserve, talking at the Reserve Officers Association's annual National Security Symposium. We're focusing this hour on the military reserve components, how they're helping to implement DOD's new defense strategy, and how they're trying to make it easier for armed forces personnel to seamlessly switch between the active and reserve components. We'll take one more break, and when we come back, get the perspective of the Marine Corps. This is On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Welcome back to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Our topic today is the military reserve components and their role in DOD's new strategy and its upcoming budget. We heard from Major General Keith Thurgood, the Chief of Staff of the Army Reserve, in the first half of the show in an interview at the Reserve Officers Association. We're spending this portion on the other services. Their leaders all spoke at the ROA meeting, too. In our final segment this week, Lieutenant General Stephen Hummer, the commander of Marine Forces Reserve.
The Marine Corps construct for active and component is as a total force. The reserve component looks an awful lot like the active component. We're called Marine Forces Reserve, but in fact we look more like a Marine Expeditionary Unit. We have a division, we have a wing, we have a Marine Logistics Group. Now, when we go to fight, it's not going to be first MEF in the middle, second MEF on the left, and Marine Forces Reserve on the right, because we're a force provider to the active component. We provide that augmentation, that reinforcement, and that sustainment that allows them to expand and contract, as I explained earlier, with that spike in 2003 at 21,000 activations. So the challenge before us is how do we preserve that operational force while retaining that strategic depth? And having talked to the Marine Corps leadership, most recently, just this last week, we had an executive offsite, and I briefed the construct of the operational reserve. During that speech, I said I was the number one proponent for the Marine Forces Reserve. And the commandant corrected me and said, no, he's the number one proponent. The assistant commandant is the number two proponent, and I'm down there somewhere with the masses. The commandant's priorities are Marine Forces Reserve priorities. The first priority is OEF in Afghanistan. What's going on in Afghanistan? Currently, we have over 1,500 Marines deployed, a majority of them actually in Afghanistan. Number two is the refit and the rebalancing of the Marine Corps. In case you haven't been paying attention, the last 10 years there's been this land army aspect of the Marine Corps that we would hope not to continue to be forced into that role. Through whatever, World War I, Korea, the Marine Corps has shown that capability to be able to shoulder with primarily the Army to go inland like that and the other services and provide a viable capability and capacity. We do want to get back to our maritime roots to be America's Expeditionary Force in readiness that we've been in the past, to be ready when the nation is least ready to be able to support. So that refitting and rebalancing is going on internal to the Marine Corps. So that's the equipment. I mean, if we took all the MRAPs right now and tried to put them on ships, those ships would sink. So that's a big part, and certainly there's a lot of money involved with that. That also, the refit and rebalance is also the manpower aspect. The commandant chartered a force structure review group over a year ago to look at the Marine Corps, knowing that there was going to be drawdowns. It wasn't, the construct was not, okay, how do we draw down 25, 27,000 Marines? It's how do we build that Marine Corps for the future that's actually going to be a smaller number? So they've taken that on. That final number has yet to settle out. However, for the Marine Forces Reserve, whose end strength is 39,600, we did not grow over the last 10 years during the conflict. So at this point, the Marine Corps has made the decision they are not going to cut from the reserves. The Commandant's third priority is education and training. What have we learned in the last 10 years? An incredible amount about complex operations, all the cultures, all the languages, all the things. If you think about what we know now in counterinsurgency compared to what we didn't know in 2001, it's absolutely staggering. Something else that we have to hang on to. So how do we hang on to what we've learned about warfighting? In the bigger context, some of the invasion context, the initial 2003 invasion of Iraq, through all the COIN experiences, then his final priority, stated priority, is what he calls keeping the faith. And that's keeping the faith with Marines, married Marines, their families, single Marines, the extended families of Marines, the parents, et cetera, the fiancés, and the communities and the employers. So providing and taking care of those Marines, doing what we need to do with the pay, the orders, the travel pieces, all those challenges with bringing reserves on orders, taking them off orders, the continuation of service, etc.
That's Lieutenant General Stephen Hummer, the commander of Marine Forces Reserve. We've been hearing today about the military reserve components and their role in the upcoming DoD drawdown. Glad you could join us today. Tune in next week for another edition of On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.